I don't know how inclusion became a political issue. Our economic, our social, our cultural future depends on everyone being included.
We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
Welcome to the Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rachel Vindman.
I'm Amanda Weinstein.
I'm Jasmine Clark.
And you're listening to the Suburban Women Problem. We're officially back in the swing of things after the holidays, and we're jumping right into it with an interview about public schools. Laura Papano is a journalist who's covered education for over 30 years, and we had such a great conversation with her about why moms like us are the perfect champions for schools. Like we always say, you don't have to be perfect to make a difference. But before we get to that, what have you guys been seeing in the news? It's been a minute since we've discussed the news.
Oh, man. It was interesting to see January 6th come around again, because that is very much like it replays in my mind. It is something that we all watched. And it was interesting to hear how divided our country still is on that. Like,
but don't you think like the narrative is changing? There were people after January 6th, 2021, and they were like, even Trump supporters or Trump voters, maybe not supporters, but people who voted for him, who said they were really upset by it. And now I think this constant drumbeat of everything the Republicans have been saying has made a difference and has made an impact. Because I feel like a lot of people have kind of changed their mind on this. I saw some polling of people who were Trump voters, then against January 6th, but now after 3 years, they have come around to the stupid narrative because they've just been eating a steady diet of it for 3 years, that it wasn't an insurrection, or maybe if they thought it was, it wasn't as bad because we're not, you know, they're only hearing people talk about it. What they're not doing is seeing the pictures constantly. Mm-hmm. And it makes a difference. And that really, really bothers me because after January 6th, as horrible as it was, I was like, look, Trump has really like lost a lot of these people. They're done. They think this is ridiculous. But now all they hear are people talking about it and they are not seeing the pictures, which were at the time very powerful. Mm.
Do you think though that it's also there are people who were Trump supporters and then they didn't like what happened on January 6th. But now that we're back in an election year and it's very likely that Trump will be on the ballot, now they've got to do the mental gymnastics to make January 6th not as bad.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not just about like hearing about it and not seeing the pictures, but it's like they are this is an internal thing. It's inside of them that they have got to get over the guilt of, I probably am still going to vote for this guy that I said bad things about. I was watching by mistake, completely by mistake, watching Meet the Press and Elise Stefanik, however you say her name. She was on there and oh my gosh, like she herself, you know, said how horrible January 6th was in the well of the Capitol. And then in the interview, when they played that, she was like, and here you are, the media, just feeding people lies. And I was like, what? Like, it's literally you on video saying these words.
This morning, my daughter, who's obviously not on any kind of political social media, right? She was eating breakfast and the Today Show was on and they showed that clip of Kristen Welker interviewing Elise Stefanik, which I prefer not to call it an interview, more like a guided lecture, more of a Q&A type situation because it's not an interview. There's no pushback. It's just asking questions and then they can say whatever the hell they want. So listen, my daughter is sitting there, the Today Show is on and they play the clip of Elise Stefanik saying that these people, the January 6th hostages. My daughter looks at me and says, why are the people, the January 6th rioters, being held hostage? This is how it works. This is how the propaganda works. The only reason Elise Stefanik went on Meet the Press is to have some clips and some sound bites that will then be played over and over and over. What I don't understand is why NBC plays that clip because it makes them look bad. Not only did Kristen Welker not push back, and honestly, if someone says something and you want to make a clip, it's easy just to, you know, even if she had pushed back, it was already said on Meet the Press, right? So like you know, the horses left the barn. But why are they then continuing to play it?
And only for January 6th. They call them hot. Like, we have a known issue of mass incarceration in this country.
Thank you.
And nowhere do we call any of the people who are incarcerated for very minor marijuana issues, which are now legal in most of the states, nowhere do we call them hostages.
That's exactly even what I thought, too.
That is much closer than the January 6th.
It's a co-opting of issues that people do care about, because that's what they do. So you use words like hostage, because it then it riles up all the feelings of what's going on in Israel and Palestine.
Yes.
We have hostages. And so it's like sick and insidious, but it is how they do things. They find the words that trigger certain emotions in people, even in people that normally would not agree with them, but they find those words and then they just use them completely out of the correct context, but they use them over and over. And then all of a sudden people start saying those things, even though those things don't actually make logical sense.
Pro-life, parents' rights. Yeah. Like, we can go through a whole list of the words that they have used, just completely incorrect. I mean, pro-life, right? So this is the party who claims that they are pro-life. Meanwhile, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said that hospitals don't have to provide abortion care to save a woman's life.
And there you have it. There you have it, right there. Okay, so this is a confession. I had a really hard time when I lived in the DC area of finding an OBGYN. So I went to this practice that was, they were very religious. And part of what they told me when I made the appointment was that they do not give birth control. They do not prescribe birth control.
Oh, wow.
Now, I didn't have any option, really. I kind of had an issue that I needed. I mean, it wasn't that serious in the end, but I didn't know. So I went to them and I had to sign something that I acknowledged. I'm like, yeah, well, it's not going to happen anyway, because I've never had like a normal pregnancy on my own. So not too worried about it. But also, I didn't think about it much. And this is I'm going to own this now, but it was real. And this practice still exists. And I mean, hey, good for them. But I've often thought about that practice since then. But now, as I understood it, and I've read quite a bit about the Fifth Circuit and this decision, is that it is really the physician's determination. But then you're at, like, just the mercy, literally, your life is at the mercy of whoever the on-call physician is at that time. I mean, if you go to a large hospital, there might be more than one physician. But if you're going to a small place in a small town or a small, who knows, okay? I mean, just stop and sit with that for a minute. Not maybe you guys, because we're recording this, but like our listeners, stop and sit with that. That this is the decision of one person. They have the power of your life in their hands, and it is based on their religious views.
It doesn't matter to them until it's their wife, until it's their sister, until it's their daughter.
They never think it'll be them.
No, then suddenly it matters to them. But it was pretty surprising in Ohio, where we had Ohio Governor Mike DeWine actually vetoed a bill that would ban gender affirming care. And he vetoed it. So if you watch his speech, he vetoed it because he's saying, like, look, I am not going to sign a bill that goes against what parents want and also what their physicians are recommending for that child.
He's also the guy who signed an anti-abortion law, basically taking rights away from women. And he had no problem with the government interjecting in a woman's bodily autonomy. So I'm very curious about, like, what happened? Who does he know? Or who was in his ear? Or who in his family pulled him to the side and said, this is affecting us? And I hate to be that cynic. I really, really do. But I just... that veto, very happy about it. And I never want to poo-poo on something good when it happens. It doesn't actually match his track record, which is why I'm very curious.
I'm sure there is more to that story. And the story is not over, unfortunately, because the legislature, because they have a super majority, could override his veto. So it's possible. Doesn't matter.
And then maybe he ain't counting on that.
It could be.
Maybe he's strategically he's counting on, I know, like, I can now go out and say, no, I support you. I've seen this happen a lot where there'll be policies that are very, quote, Democratic or left-leaning policies. They're not really left-leaning policies. They're just good policy, mm-hmm. but they're policy being put forth by Democrats. And so what Republicans do is they'll be against it in front of everyone and then somehow reword it or rewrite it or redo the message to make it palatable to Republicans. But then when they go into their districts, they talk about how moderate they are. And it's like, no, you didn't actually do that because you cared about the policy. You do that because the numbers said that you will lose your election.
Yep. Playing politics.
I did want to just touch on, we've had a lot in our group chat about this because you're both academics. And well, Amanda is doing something a little different now, but she has a PhD. So she's familiar with the PhD, with the dissertation process and academic writing, as is Jasmine when she's doing her, you know, one of her 18 jobs.
So many jobs.
I really feel like I need to get a PhD, although that's never going to happen, just to hang with you guys. But so let's talk about Claudine Gay and some of the talk that we have had amongst us.
Chris Rufo wrote the original Substack to really get people on this, who is the original, let's make CRT happen or not happen here, whatever. Let's make CRT a big deal. He's working with Moms for Liberty. Like, he is absolutely wanting to completely tear apart public education and completely tear apart higher education. That's his goal.
Yes, there it is, an attack on higher education.
Yes.
I think that she was the sacrificial lamb. Mm-hmm. I think that they nitpicked and found ways to make her out to be, you know, just completely demonize her. Now, am I saying that she is without fault? I don't know. I didn't read her dissertation. I'm going to be honest. I didn't. I'm not going to sit up here and act like, I'm not going to act like these other people. I did not read her dissertation.
But there is a Harvard article out there that Harvard wrote where they actually will go through and compare the two. You can compare it for yourself and you can see which wording is the same and which wording is different. And they even interviewed the people from the papers that she's accused of plagiarizing from. And at least two authors of those papers said, I don't really consider this plagiarism. So like the gray area that you started talking about, there is a lot of gray area, even from the people who supposedly she plagiarized from, say, like, I don't really see this as plagiarism. And it's not that easy when you see a lot of the news articles, they don't actually go into that or say that. They just call it plagiarism.
They don't know.
No.
They have no idea what they're talking about.
And again, I do feel like Dr. Gay became the sacrificial lamb in all of this. And I really hate it because I do feel like some people use this as an opportunity to attack why Black women should not run institutions.
Absolutely. I think that was like the first line of attack, don't you think?
Yeah, it was pretty much like, see, this is why we shouldn't have, quote, diversity hires. And
some people are allowed to make mistakes and some are not.
Yeah. That was the real objective, is to find a Black person that they could use as an example of why Black people don't deserve to be in these positions. And billionaires have enough money to create that narrative and do that. And that's kind of what happened.
There's something, whenever you partner with people and whenever you do things for dishonest reasons, it always comes back to bite you in the end. As Taylor Swift says, trash always takes itself out. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer than others. But it's true. Okay, now we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Laura Papano.
This week, we're talking about the importance of inclusion in education, especially as extremists try to scapegoat the most vulnerable among us, like LGBTQ kids. Amanda just mentioned the bill in Ohio that would ban critical gender-affirming care. If you're in Ohio, please call your state reps and tell them to vote no on overturning Governor DeWine's veto of HB 68. The vote could happen as early as today, Wednesday, so please stay informed on this issue. It's rapidly changing, but it's important that our reps know our values. And speaking of supporting the LGBTQ community, we're also hosting a live virtual event with author and former podcast, Leslia Newman, on Tuesday, January 16th, to talk about her new book, Always Matt, a tribute to Matthew Shepard. You can find more info in the show notes.
Our guest today is a journalist who's written about K through 12 and higher education for over 30 years. She's the author of a new book called School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Laura Papano, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thrilled to be with you guys.
Well, we talk a lot about public schools on this podcast, and not just because we're moms. Schools are really at the center of our culture and politics right now. You write, it's not just the curriculum, but the experience of school that's important. Could you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, John Dewey, the 20th century ed reformer, made the point that, you know, kids were not going to learn to be, you know, citizens and part of our democracy by taking government classes and civics classes, but that it happened through social relations, through the daily experience of school. And, you know, the reality is that that's still true. We learn because we are with people who are different from us, and we learn things about them. And, you know, that's the part that I think is getting broken right now, is that school, the far right has made schools a platform for political posturing, gain, and all kinds of froth. And I'll give you an example. It's like, and I realized the pain of this when I was talking with a mom in Texas. We're meeting at a coffee shop, and she made the point to me. She said, you know, my son plays water polo, and I do the food for the water polo team. She said, but I, and this is a quote, I can't get on the theater booster board because conservatives run that. I can't get on the choir booster board because conservatives run that. So what is this? What's happening is not just a challenge to the life of the school, which is so important, but it's a challenge to our communities.
Oh, I think that's such a good point, that the experience of school is also part of the learning. And I know there's a lot of research even related to like early childhood education and related to moving to neighborhoods, that a lot of the biggest impact came long run, and it came from those improvements that kids had and all of the behavioral type outcomes that were improved and all of that experience of school that really mattered long term for kids. And there's a lot of stuff that teachers are dealing with in and out every day when you think about classroom management. And we hear a lot of like talking points of like, just teach math, when it's like, yeah, I'm trying to teach math, but all of that goes along with teaching math and how that experience of that school also contributes to learning in school.
And that's, you're exactly 1,000% right, because you can't teach math if somebody stole someone's glitter pen and everyone is thinking about it.
Exactly.
I would also add to that, that you can't teach math if the students are hungry, mm-hmm. and they're thinking about, you know, their next meal or things like that. And so that's where I do think our larger society and the policies that we implement in our larger society and community affect our schools. And then what happens in schools affects our larger society.
And that hunger issue is real. I run a school newspaper for kids in New Haven, grades 3 through 8, and they decide what they want to write about. We're doing a story right now about being hungry in school. And it's not necessarily related to just, you know, economic and family situation. It's also the timing of meals. Like if you get your breakfast at 8:10 and then your lunch is at 10:30, you're not necessarily hungry. And then, but by 1 o'clock, you're starving.
Right.
We did a survey, and 84% of students said they were hungry during the school day.
Wow. That, so I think you see a lot of time and money being poured into school board races now. But at the same time, I think we're missing issues like you're talking about. We're missing issues that matter to kids and matter to families. Like, are kids hungry? Are we dealing with having the best experience and environment for kids to learn in? So how can we channel this energy to benefit our schools instead of tearing them down?
Whew. Isn't that the question? I mean, because what's happening right now is not about education. We all know that. Mm-hmm. That these battles are a distraction from the work that really needs to be done. And, you know, as we discussed, it's not just reading and math, but we should be focusing on how do we include everyone? How do we teach better? How do we have better environment in school that makes everyone feel as if they belong? And I think, I mean, if we look at the demographics of school, right, in 1986, they were, you know, 70% white. By 2020, it's 47% white. We have a lot of different children in the school, and everyone needs to feel that they belong and they're included. And that allows them to be part of the life of the school, allows them to learn. The distraction of the school board races is targeting kids who they feel, you know, don't belong. And I find, I don't know how inclusion became a political issue, because it really shouldn't be. Our economic, our social, our cultural future depends on everyone being included.
I agree with you. I think that we are really dealing with an uphill battle when we start to choose marginalized, already vulnerable groups of people and make them our targets. And so in your book, you tell a powerful story about a mom who's just making signs in her school district that said, "You belong, you matter." So you just talked about belonging. Could you just tell us about that particular story?
Sure. So Kristen Bruck was a, you know, she was a 20-year veteran teacher, a mom of two, and in her district in, you know, Southern Lehigh Valley, she noticed that suddenly a sign that had been up for years in a teacher's classroom that basically said, you know, women's rights are human rights, everyone matters, everyone belongs, love is love, suddenly blew up on their local social media, and people were getting really angry about it. And she noticed that at school board meetings, people would line up and you know, pontificate about and argue against this sign, and because people believed it was a political message. And she was noticing, because she has two teenagers, she was noticing that kids were tuning in to see what the adults were saying. And she realized that that was having an effect on how kids felt. So she just started, she got together with a friend who is a graphic designer, made signs, and stuck one in her lawn and stuck one in some intersections. And just with the simple message, you belong, you matter. Well, teachers, you know, a teacher asked for signs. Everyone started talking about them. A teacher got two of them. One for her, one for another teacher. And then a parent was touring the intermediate school, spotted the sign, and just an uproar ensued that, you know, this was a political statement, that belonging is a political statement. And and we've seen that elsewhere. We saw that in Central Bucks County in Pennsylvania, where pride flags had to be taken down. And, you know, there's an interpretation that including everyone is a political statement. And what was wonderful was that as this was going on, more and more people from different districts were like, hey, these kids in our district, they need this affirmation. And the signs have just exploded, and she has turned into a nonprofit. I was texting with her yesterday, and she said that, you know, they've gone to Illinois and Oregon and Arizona and town throughout Pennsylvania. They're shipping them out all over the place.
You also went to the Moms for Liberty National Summit in 2022.
Yes.
I feel like we're taking this from a really high place to Moms for Liberty level. And that's okay. But I mean, it just should come with like a warning. That's what we're doing. Okay.
Okay. So the first Moms for Liberty Summit that was in Tampa, as a journalist, I knew I was writing a book. So I didn't register as a daily journalist. I just registered under my name. And, you know, I paid the fee and got the hotel room in the Moms for Liberty Hotel. The woman who was checking me in just like winked and said, you know, I'm with you all. And so she goes, I'm upgrading everyone. And so I was upgraded to this high floor with a water view in Tampa just because she made some assumptions. And I did, you know, I did dress the part. I wore blue slacks, a white, you know, top and a red blazer with an American flag pin on the lapel.
Nice.
And I recorded the entire session, all 4 days of it. And but what I noticed as a journalist, I expected that I would be confused. Meaning, I have been in many situations over 30 years where I go into a situation and, you know, I put my own personal beliefs aside, and I really just listen. And there are times where I'm like, you know what, I would not have understood where they're coming from, but I get this. And I expected that to happen with this conference. And what I found was anything but. I mean, it was, I mean, the extremist language from day one was absolutely stunning to be told, to, you know, a whole 500 moms being told that sending your children to public schools for 30 to 35 hours a week was like sending them to a Maoist reform prison camp. I mean, quoting Lenin, quoting Hitler, quoting Mao. And what I realized is that there was, it was almost as if the whole thing were a scripted performance, right down to the outfits. I mean, the three Moms for Liberty co-founders were in one panel discussion, and they sat on stools wearing red, white, and then a blue with some, like, you know, stars or dots on it. And I thought, this is just a bit too much. And on Sunday morning, you know, Tina Deskovich comes out in a lemon yellow A-line, you know, 1950s style dress. And there was a whole kind of trope where every time there was a woman on the stage who was being introduced, she would be identified as her familial role. You know, she was a mother of X number of grandmother. And they were often waving to their husbands from the stage. It was a very kind of, I read it as really an effort to kind of make all the women who they repeatedly said, you know, we understand you may not be comfortable with being in the public eye. You may not be comfortable stepping up, but there's an exception here. Your children are in grave, grave danger.
I'm curious about this. And I don't want to get into the salaciousness of it, although it is kind of funny, but the recent scandals, let's just say, of Moms for Liberty, do you think that this will diminish their influence at this time, or it will cause anyone to pause like, I wonder if this is like the real deal, or perhaps this is just more people like praying? Because I do think that some people on the right have been given pause, let's say, over some of the scandals from even Trump, I mean, and DeSantis, and they see it as ploys and they don't see them as genuine. Do you think this will have the same effect in the Moms for Liberty space?
Unfortunately, I feel it won't. And the reason is this, is that I think one thing it reveals is it reveals that this is not really about the issues that they say it's about. It's really just using whatever gets people all worked up and in order to gain power and gain a political edge. That's what this is. So it reveals the kind of baldness of the effort, right? And on the backs of the most vulnerable people and students, and which I find unconscionable.
Of course.
So you have that. And I know that during the November elections that the Moms for Liberty did not do as well as they had probably hoped, and that in many, many places they were defeated. I think they only got 50 school board seats across the country. Obviously, every school board was not up for election. But I think what, you know, what we are seeing is that there are some people giving some pause, but it's really a personal community pause. I was recently in North Idaho, and I did a story for Hechinger Report and Vanity Fair, in which, you know, conservative Republican religious moms were fighting against extremists, you know, in their district who wanted to really take away public education. And in many communities, moms are like, we need public education. We need these schools. So they said, we're conservative, and there's nothing wrong with conservative values. We're conservative, but we're not extremists. So, I mean, I think that there are people who are giving pause. At the same time, there is no Moms for Liberty in North Idaho. And there are other groups that are really kind of assuming the language and the arguments of Moms for Liberty in some places, you know, effectively. And that, you know, and as, you know, as you all know, it comes down to voter turnout, right? So if somebody is pouring money in, as we talked about a minute ago, into school board races, and you have, you know, in some Texas races I looked at, you know, turnout was 8% and 10%. When you have a low turnout race, you have money being poured in and the issue really comes down the voter to voter, you know, name recognition, that's dangerous.
And the name recognition can be purchased with all that money. That's really what they're doing, is they're purchasing name recognition. But I just, you know, I don't want to downplay that there are places where there is a ton of money being spent and it is having a result. But when you have 8 to 10% turnout, there's no margin for error. And it's kind of impossible with that low of turnout in a very conservative area. And what we have to see is a grassroots effort to counter that. And it's very possible, but it is not something you're going to be able to start in September. Okay. You're going to have to, I'm just saying this to our listeners, you're going to have
now.
To start now. I'll just give shameless plug, redwine.blue. There are resources. Please go on there. We will talk about it more, but this is my life song this year, guys. It is possible, but not without work. And the work has to start now.
But I also love that I know you interviewed Katie Paris with Red, Wine, and Blue. And we have seen a lot of big news organizations Clear's Throat, CBS Sunday Morning, highlight Moms for Liberty as this grassroots movement that there's something that we should like pay attention to, when we don't often see the same attention given to real grassroots organizing, stuff that Red, Wine, and Blue is doing in Katy Paris. But I know that you actually interviewed Katy Paris for your book. I would love to hear more about your chat with her and about suburban women and how we can use our power. And why did you think it was so important to interview Katy and talk about Red, Wine, and Blue?
Well, how could I not interview Katy? I mean, that's the question, is that...
That's a great answer.
I called the book School Moms for a reason, not for Moms for Liberty, but I wasn't going to let Moms for Liberty own the moms, right? With Katy, I mean, we both were still in our workout clothes and on a Zoom late in the day. And she had one of her sons zooming into the Zoom looking for cleats, and without losing a beat, she said, in the soccer bag, check the soccer bag. I've been there 1,000 times. I've spent so many sideline soccer games talking with people and in the car, like doing research for articles. But mom power is real, and I think Red, Wine, and Blue is a I can't tell you how many people that I've interviewed and I've said, you might want to go check this out, because you guys are you're answering the sass, it's sassy, it's fun, great vibe. And you recognize that, people don't want to feel that people are drawn by their passion for something. They don't want to feel like they're just cogs carrying out somebody else's, kind of grand plan, but that this is a communal enterprise. And I think in places where you have made it a communal social enterprise, that is really incredibly powerful. And the results are there. I of course tracked all of you guys throughout election day. It matters, but it is hard work. I look at, Kate Nazemi, Advocates for Inclusive Education in Central Bucks County, which had fantastic result. But do you know how much work? You do know how much
work. Yeah, so much work.
Real grassroots is a lot of work.
Yeah, it is.
And you're not handed $1 million checks.
No, yeah. It's like I read the newsletters and the stuff that you guys produce. I mean, it is a lot of work, but what we have learned is that work matters.
The thing is we were born for this. We can do this. I mean, I was outside talking to my sister-in-law yesterday, and my daughter came in and was like, there's no ketchup, which is a great tragedy. And I told her exactly where in the pantry she could look back to my conversation seamlessly. Same thing as Katy and the cleats. I mean, she was convinced there was no ketchup, and there were like probably 3 bottles. But this is, we can do this. We have to do this. And, you have no greater, I think, example than to see the marginal successes with hundreds of thousands of dollars that the conservatives are having and the success that we are having when we get on the ground and work.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, this has been amazing. Thank you. We so appreciate you joining us, but you don't get to leave yet until we do our rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of schools, what was your favorite class when you were in school?
Okay. So My favorite, I have two answers here. They'll be quick. One is that English ended up being my favorite class. But when I first had English in sixth grade, I was forced to diagram sentences. And I hated it so much. I didn't even know what it was for. I was like, and I failed the test. I got like a 65. I was like, man, I am going to have nothing to do with English. That changed, of course. And then the other class that was really a revelatory class for me was industrial arts in seventh grade. I was the only girl in my class. And I remember the first project was making a seed board. And, you know, you're cutting wood and you're gluing things on. And Mr. Messer, you know, does the whistle, gathers everyone around. And I'm like, oh, my God. If anyone has done something wrong, it has got to be me, because I am not supposed to be in this class. And everybody leading up to me being in it let me know that. Well, you know what? Greg B. had cut his board to the wrong length. And it was the first time I ever thought that a boy could make a mistake with wood. And it was just this idea that and it made me realize how much our expectations of what we can and can't do and what we shouldn't do is so built in that sometimes we self-censor ourselves.
I love that. All right. So what inspires you?
Oh, so, you know what? People like you guys inspire me. Honestly, I didn't plan to write this book. I didn't want to write this book. I was, you know, just writing about education stuff. And I started seeing all of this, you know, going down. And I was like, this is not, you know, teachers are not trying to change the gender of your child. I mean, this is not the stuff that people are claiming is not actually happening in schools.
We just want you to read the chapter. Just read the chapter.
Right.
We can't even get that done.
I love the way you all are standing up day after day and speaking out and sharing and connecting and basically saying, we're not going to stand for this. That inspires me. That really, really inspires me.
Your book, School Moms, is coming out on January 30th. So could you tell our listeners where they can learn more about it?
So you can learn about it on my website, laurapapano.com. It is on the Beacon Press website. It is, it's available everywhere. So please check it out. And because, you know, I wrote this to have a conversation.
Well, it is on my list. I so look forward to it. And just thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming to speak to us today and for joining us on the Suburban Women Problem.
Oh, you guys have a great podcast. You know that one of the things I do on Peloton is I turn off the actual instructors and put on your podcast.
Oh, wow. I love it.
So thank you all.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone.
What a great interview.
I know. I really loved her. She was awesome.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I read her Vanity Fair piece, which I think everyone should do. We'll link it in the show notes. And I just really look forward to reading this book. But in the meantime, read this story in Vanity Fair about these moms in Idaho who are like also conservative, but just not like, you know, Gilead conservative and kind of want to like not live in a theocracy. So it was great. And like there's a quote in there from a police chief that was like, if you asked me if I wanted to go to a bank robbery or a school board meeting, I probably choose the bank robbery.
And it was also refreshing to see her like wanting to talk to real moms, right? Not just the Moms for Liberty moms who are going to school board meetings, trying to go viral and saying crazy stuff, but real moms who just care about their kids and they just care about their schools.
I also just applaud her bravery in like going and stepping into the fire multiple times. Like she runs into the burning building. She went to Moms for Liberty conference, not once, but twice. Like, yeah, like that is, to me, very admirable.
That is taking two for the team right there.
It really was. I mean, for her, it was really about being there and, you know, telling the story and not, you know, doing it from the sidelines. Like, her story is from the front lines. Like, I sat in the room. I listened to the things that I listened to. I heard what I heard, and I my mouth dropped a couple of times, but I was there. And I don't think that I do think that a lot of times, you know, we kind of see the clips, the crazy clips, because they do go viral. But she was in there, and she not only saw the clip, she felt the energy. So I think that's, kudos to her for being willing to like put herself out there and do that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
And not just relying on what other people said about them, which is easier, I guess, but like, I'm going to go find out for myself.
No, I really liked it. And I really look forward to reading this book. It comes out in January it comes out later this month, but her reporting has been so deep and so thorough. And she has talked to so many people, and the way she kind of put that together, was really good. And, there are great journalists out there, guys. I never, ever want to disparage all journalists, but you have to understand people sometimes do it for different reasons, or they're willing to do things in order to stay on air or make money for whatever outlet they work for. And we just have to be really, really careful, especially going into an election year, to be good consumers and, you know,
check the ingredients. I'm an ingredient checker, like going through the grocery store, right? You flip it over, see what's in there. We have to do the same with our media, right? We still need it. We need good journalism, but check the ingredients.
It's a great idea. I like that. Check the ingredients. Yes.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's true. Well, I think it's time to end on our toast to joy, a happy note. Amanda, what is yours this week?
Oh, so much. All right. My favorite has to be our good friend, Shamus Malik. Our good friend, Mayor Shamus Malik, was sworn in as mayor of Akron. And he is not only the youngest mayor of Akron ever to be sworn in, he's also the first mayor of color. So I was so honored to get to be there and see it. And actually, our daughter Amelia and Casey got to do the Pledge of Allegiance, which was super cute just to get to see and be a part of. But it was a great event, and you really saw the community turn out. So congratulations to Mayor Malik. We are also excited. I also loved his message, which he says over and over. It's not just him. This is us coming together for Akron. This has to be a team effort. We have to do this together. It's not just one person who's going to save us. There's no Superman here. It is about community.
I love that. That's the type of message you need to hear from a mayor.
All right, Jasmine, what's your toast to joy?
It's the first week of session here in Georgia. So we're recording on Monday. So today is the first day of session. And so I'm just really looking forward to a great session. I've already dropped a bill, first day at school. And we dropped a bill that will increase insulin access, especially like short term, like that little gap sometimes where people run out of insulin and they, you know, just to make sure that there's funding for that. And so very excited about that, but also just excited to hit the ground running for our second year of my third term as a state legislator. So my toast to joy is just to having a great session. I'm just going to call it early because I feel like I'm in for a roller coaster. It's an election year. So great session. Yes, we're going to have a great session.
I love that you talked about like dropping a bill like it's a new release of a song. And I feel like we should talk about bills that way all the time.
I know. Make it exciting. Like, oh, I just dropped my brand new bill, insulin access, get it in stores. No.
Well, my toast to joy this week is actually to Jasmine. Alex and I were really happy to participate in a virtual fundraiser that she did. And we just walked away so encouraged. And she's not going to say this, but I am. It was really unfair. You cannot donate to Georgia state legislators during session. So she did it the first week of January because she had to do it before the session began. And all while she is in session, her opponent will be able to raise money unlimitedly, and Jasmine will basically be barred from doing so. So watch out, because we'll hit the ground running in April, whenever the session ends. But really, like, just the questions that people asked were great.
Really good questions.
I mean, it's not just the questions that people ask, but they were like really informed questions. And I mean, some, I had no idea what they're talking about because it's very Georgia specific, but I mean, good, because we need it to be Georgia specific. I mean, everyone, people know the big issues, but we need to know what's happening in our communities and our state. And they were really like informed about that. And I loved it. And I thought it was a great way to start the year, and kudos to you for doing it. And I hope that, you know, all those people, I know you're in a new district, and I really hope that, you know, old and new constituents will help you, because I know you have a real battle. We've talked about that before. But we're all on Team Jasmine. So right now you need to help do your job, one of your 18 jobs as a legislator. And then when that's over, let's raise you some money so we can keep you in office. And I think that's really important. So
thanks so much.
Yeah, you are my toast to joy. Aww, so with that, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We will see you again next week on another episode of The Suburban Women Problem.
The Suburban Women Problem was created by Red, Wine, and Blue. Our producer and editor is Amy Thorstenson. Our project manager is Lindsay Quist, and our editorial assistant is Abigail Martin. For more information about upcoming events and trainings, or to learn more about Red, Wine, and Blue, follow us on social media or at www.redwine.blue.